That's Segundo here. Nothing to say about this week's guest, but this, John F. Kennedy was a fool.
Okay, so I am here with Nora Ephron, author of I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts of Being a Woman, which is a very interesting title. How are you doing, Nora?
So far, I'm doing fine.
Okay.
Yes, I think.
You think?
I think I am, yes. Yes, well, it's...
You're uncertain of whether you feel fine or not.
Well, no, it's just because I just had a lot of cake.
Okay.
So I'm probably having sort of... I'm probably about to go into a diabetic coma, but other than that, I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you often feel this way with cake, or...?
I don't have as much cake as I just had. Ah. I just had a lot of cake as part of my book tour. Someone took me to a lot of bakeries, and I ate everything in them.
Well, so this is a proviso for actually going on tour, eating a lot of cake.
It's not a bad one, do you think?
No, I don't think so.
Yes, yes. I think life should be full of a lot of cake.
Well, the problem is that you'll get confused with Marie Antoinette, so that might be...
No, no, Marie Antoinette did not say that. I just want to say that about Marie.
Okay.
She did not say, let them eat cake. I am perfectly willing to say, let everyone eat cake. Mm-hmm. Not in the way that she was... misquoted as to have meant it. I think everyone should have as much cake as possible.
So we need to take that quote from Marie Antoinette, or
well,
the actual
it has
context.
Been taken back, but no one told you, but I'm happy to be the first person to tell you that Marie Antoinette did not say, let them eat cake.
Okay.
When the peasants had no bread. Mm. Of course you understand.
It's
what
misquoted. It's taken out of context.
But not in that context, I think everyone should eat cake and bread. That's one of the things my book is about.
Okay.
Is how to get older. Mm-hmm. And one way to get older is to do things so that when you are lying there in your last moments, you don't think, I should have had that piece of cake.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, sure. I can get behind
that. You say
that,
but you're too young to even know what I'm talking about.
No.
Yes.
It's starting to catch up with me gradually. Yeah. I mean, I've got a long, long road to walk. So
yes.
Anyway, I do empathize and I do agree with you.
I'm not asking for your empathy.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, what would you like from me? Would you like...
I would like anything you want, but not empathy.
Not empathy?
No.
Okay,
no.
Okay. That's good.
Anyway,
okay.
You couldn't possibly have any empathy for this. You're too young.
Well, I have empathy for the whole notion of, like, the older... did you hear about the... This is totally... I haven't even asked my first question.
I hope this is about Marie. Yes, what?
Well, it's not about Marie, but did you hear about Madrid?
What about Madrid?
They have actually, today, they announced a ban on super thin models.
They did?
Mm-hmm. If you have a body mass...
You're just making that up.
No, I swear to goodness. I mean, you know, and the body...
I think that's against the law.
Well, not in Spain. In Spain, it's actually shocked the fashion industry. If you have a body mass index of, like, under 18, mm-hmm. then you can't participate in the modeling show. And
that's the silliest thing I've ever heard.
It's true.
Well, that's
reported
silly.
By the Washington
I practically
Post.
Have a body mass of under 18, and I'm not too thin. I mean, I'm not. Mm-hmm. So that makes no sense. People should be able to model. I don't like really super thin models, but the truth is there are very few people who are genuinely super thin. Even Kate Moss, who's often given trouble for being super thin, isn't really. So
what would you define as super thin?
Oh, like those people like Nicole Richie that I see pictures of in Us magazine, who I don't know who they are.
Yeah.
But they are clearly suffering from major eating disorders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, in 1975, you wrote an infamous essay called A Few Words About Breasts, and mm-hmm. now we are on the subject.
No, before that.
Before that?
Yeah.
That was, when was that?
1972, I think that was. Yeah.
Okay. You've gone from breasts to necks, and I'm wondering, what is it about anatomical components that actually sort of, that's your muse, that is your...
Well, I've written a trillion things. Yeah. One of them is about breasts and one of them is about necks. It is true, but I do think that women think about the parts of their body. Mm-hmm. I do, and so I wrote these two things over, like, 4-year period, yes.
Well, I don't mean to imply that you just wrote about anatomical parts, but I am going to suggest here that they do form the sort of the thing that people kind of hover around. That's the title essay here. It's the major essay that launched your career as a writer. I mean, I'm just wondering if there's anything about, you know, anatomy that sort of, you know,
destiny.
Destiny?
I don't know. I mean, there's no question that I did once write a piece about breasts and having small breasts that was a kind of one of those moments where you write it and then you and it kind of crystallizes something for people. And when I began writing the piece that's the lead piece in this book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, there was also no question in my mind that no one had said what I was about to say, which is how unbelievably shocking it is at a certain point in your life to realize that you are getting older and that your neck is the dead giveaway to it. That, of course, you can wear a turtleneck, but not in the summertime. And you can wear a scarf, but you look like Katharine Hepburn in On Golden Pond. I mean, you just look, you know, you suddenly notice that all of the people in your age bracket are in this some form of camouflage right up to their chin, because we all know that whatever we can do to our faces, and we can do quite a lot to them to make them look younger, our necks are the dead giveaway.
How does the neck sort of, you know, come into play? You mentioned that, you know, hair dye is the sort of great equalizer in terms of like the ageism chasm. Does the neck kind of fall into, you know, I mean, these are two separate essays, but is there any kind of interrelation between the two of them? Or?
Well, hair dye is something you can do to make yourself look younger.
Sure.
That does not involve total anesthesia.
Yes.
But the only thing you can really do to make your neck look younger involves total anesthesia. Of course, you can pin it back with a clothespin, but I don't recommend that.
Well, what if societal norms change and, you know, necks of all kinds actually totally change?
Yeah, well, not in my lifetime.
Yeah. Well,
good luck for yours. I don't think that's going to happen.
We could start a
leaflet. I think everything's going in the other direction, I'm afraid. I think that people, not just my age, but people much younger are doing things to themselves. I'm sort of shocked because everyone always says 60 is the new 40 or 50 is the new 40 or whatever, but the truth is 30 is the new 42, in that people who are 30 are doing all sorts of cosmetic things to themselves that people used to wait until they were 50 and 60 to do. I just think I'll have a little Botox in that. And people who I think, why would you do that? You're still young. But,
well, it depends on whether you subscribe to the aesthetic culture or not. I mean, I'm gleefully going bald, I'll have you know.
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah. But I know a lot of men who aren't, who have gone to these amazing doctors who have this technology that now prevents it completely. I have at least a half a dozen male friends that you would never guess in a trillion years had this done to themselves. So... But I, you know, it's like going gray.
Yeah.
You do what you want to do.
Sure.
You know.
Well, it's not just a question of, it's the kind of individual streak of doing what you want to do up against the sort of, whatever sort of societal norms are laid down that cause these extraordinary things like the ban on super thin models in Spain. Which
yes.
is just like that we actually have to have now a safeguard in the other direction.
I can hardly believe that you're telling me about these super thin models. No, they'll probably be all over cable news instead of Iraq.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in the Washington Post. I read it in the Washington Post.
That's amazing.
As you know. Well, I actually wanted to actually have you respond to one of the reviews of this book, the Cleveland Plain Dealers.
Oh, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I hope they're not going to... Were they mean?
No,
is that
no,
why
no.
you chose them?
They were.
Out of all my great reviews, are you now going to throw something mean at me?
No. I mean, okay. They said their headline, their lead was, "We expect more from Nora Ephron."
Yeah, but, see, I knew you were going to do that. I've gotten 99 great reviews on this book, and now I hear about the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
Hey,
that is so churlish of you.
They're hard in Cleveland.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Well, anyway, actually, though,
I expect less of the Cleveland Plain. I have no expectations from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, but... Anyway, go on.
They're hard in Ohio. But the point is she actually raised an interesting point that
I'll be the judge of that.
Well, she pointed out that the books has a tendency to kind of have the essays begin or use sentences like, you know, "I feel bad about my neck, I hate my purse, I hate that I need reading glasses." And actually, I think that she does have a certain point for this. What is it about the sort of declarative kind of kvetching that kind of gets you maybe riffing on a theme or... Maybe you can...
This is the silliest question I've ever heard. I do feel bad I need reading glasses. I do. I mean, it's one of the things I was trying to write about in this book is... that it's not like, oh, isn't it great that we're older? It's that it is full of things that are constantly upsetting to you, and upsetting in a way more profound way than what I'm saying. I don't feel bad about my neck. I'm happy to be alive. If my neck turned into some horrible wrinkled thing, I would still be happier to be alive than that my neck was falling apart, which it is. But the main thing is that old age is this unbelievable mixture of complete joy that you're on the planet and complete shock that navigating it becomes so much more difficult. And when you're dealing with just the reading glasses of it, which are such a simple thing, everyone knows reading glasses, big deal, you can buy them at the drugstore. What is it about reading glasses? What it is that if you've spent your life as a reader, if you've spent your life seeing something you want to read and thinking, I'm going to pick this up and read it, and suddenly, between that impulse and the ability to read, comes the never-ending search for your glasses, the never-ending shock that the glasses that worked for you yesterday are now not strong enough, the never-ending frustration that you are one away from one of the things that gives you the most pleasure on the planet. It's very, very shocking, especially since, like all things about old age, it is such a surprise when it happens. You actually think for a while, oh, I'm not going to need reading glasses. Oh, I'm not going to go through menopause. I'm going to be the only woman on the planet who doesn't. I'm not going to die. I am never going to die. I'm going to live till I'm 102 and never lose my faculties, and I'm not going to die. Except, like, in this fabulous drift away way. You know, but I don't want to answer this critic because...
Well, I'm actually more interested, though, in the declarative sentences. I'm going to bring up a very interesting tangent here. Have you heard of the experimental novelist David Markson? You
read him? No.
He writes these interesting books and actually deals with this very, very sort of thing. In fact, one of the essays in this book is composed entirely of single sentences, but his books are basically just, you know, single sentences for each, you know, each thing declaring a different thing, and generally like some cultural minutiae, some sort of like, you know, reference to a historical figure. But what he did in his last book, which was very interesting, was that, you know, he's 82, and he's like gradually describing, you know, author is, you know, going and colliding into walls. And he describes, using this very sort of simple, plain kind of declarative sentence, just how much of, you get the sense of how much of a shock this is to him. And that's kind of what I think you're sort of doing with just by just declaring it, as opposed to, you know, adorning it with some clause
or
something.
Yes, exactly. You know? I mean, there's no, you know, so much is written about old age, not by this man I have not read, but who sounds very good, but so much is written about this just boosterism. Because I guess people think no one wants to buy a book where you say what we all know, which is what a mixed bag this period of our lives turns out to be. So I thought it would be good to just say it, just get it out there, instead of these things called the joy of your golden years. You know, who are we kidding? People are dying all around us, and we're going to be next.
Well, apparently people do want to hear it, or at least they want to hear it from you.
I hope so.
Well, it shot up to number one on the New York Times.
It did, I know. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. I was surprised. I was like, wow.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing.
Well, I mean, the thing that's interesting about this, and this kind of ties into sort of your career trajectory as a writer, you started off writing for Esquire, and you wrote, you know, very sort of like, you know, with the same kind of thing we're talking about. Very sort of confessional, this is it. This is what life is all about. And yet at the same time, you've managed to find this interesting kind of, you know, life, you know, writing very successful comedies. This book being sort of a New York Times, well, not just sort of, it is the New York Times bestseller. I'm wondering why do you think accounts for the fact that you can both reach a mainstream audience and also tell people the truth like this?
Oh, well, I don't think people buy books that are full of lies. I don't. I mean, the truth is that's one of the reasons why a lot of those books about old age didn't sell, is that people immediately see that if a book is going to tell them that their golden years are the best years of their lives, it's who's going to read this when we all know the reality, which, you know, which is just so much more complicated and interesting. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
Well, particularly when we're talking about human behavior, but, I mean, are there any sort of expanses here where, you can't always tell the truth about everything, because inevitably...
and something you think is the truth may not be somebody else's truth, but if you're lucky, the truth you're telling is somebody else's truth. Mm-hmm. And so you reach people, you know. I mean, the title of this book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, that's just something that women look at and they start laughing because they know what you're talking about. Sure. And it's just the question that is the absolute question that I ask myself when I see someone on television saying how great life is when they're older. Don't you have a neck?
Sure.
You know?
Is writing then for you just a matter of kind of seeking the sort of the ultimate universal truth? How can I sort of express some very kind of obvious, truthful, and painful thing in one sentence?
No, I don't think so. But I do think that when you're writing an essay, if you're just talking about the essay form, that's probably a classic goal of it, is to say something that isn't quite what other people have said, that people will go, oh yes, that's the truth on that subject. And we all think that when we read essays that work for us. So yeah, to a certain degree. But sometimes you say something that's true for you that's only true for not for everybody. And sometimes you say something and you look at it and a few weeks later you think, do I believe that? Mm-hmm. You know.
Sure. I actually wanted to kind of go back in your career, and some people have sort of speculated, I think I would be among them, that you kind of came about roughly around the same time as the new journalism crowd, and yet, you know, they focused on Joan Didion over you, and yet I would also argue that this kind of directness, this kind of sort of truth-telling is just as sort of pivotal to a kind of new journalism or a kind of sort of expressive journalism that you have.
Thank you, but I don't think that's true. I think that I think I've done some nice long reporting pieces, and I've certainly done a lot of essays, but I don't think that I did anything particularly new. I don't. I think my essays are very much in the classic essay form that I studied in college, actually, and got my only D.
Really?
And yes, from Miss Lever at Wellesley College, who gave me a D on a perfectly good essay.
Is she still around, and can we have
No, that? She's not, but I know that she was mortified when I became a successful essayist, because I didn't think she had a lot of students who did, and she had actually given me a D.
Wow.
But I never forgot it.
What did she take offense to?
I think what I was saying in an essay. I think I wrote a very perverse essay and she didn't like it. But that's okay. It's all right. It worked out okay. But I think that my long reporting pieces were not, you know, I mean, I'm not sure how, quote, new, unquote, the new journalism was. I think some of it, like Tom Wolfe's stuff, which is brilliant, was new stylistically, but it wasn't really new in other ways. I mean, there had been a lot of good reporting done in the 40 or 50 years before, you know, magazine writing that wasn't new journalism in some way. Now we know that Truman Capote's new journalism was partly fabricated.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other thing that we're adjusting to.
But
Gay Talese, who is a brilliant journalist and one of the greatest journalists that I know, I think is just a great journalist. I don't know what exactly was new about what he did, except that he just did it so much better than most people did it. So I've never been sure what the new journalism is.
Did you ever, while you were at Esquire...
But I did not begrudge other people being called it when I wasn't. And Joan Didion's stuff, you know, I just think is fantastic, you know. But I think stylistically is where Joan is truly unique, not not, you know, no one could have, you open, you know, it's like a Diane Arbus photograph. You read a paragraph and you think Joan Didion wrote that. No one else could have written that.
Sure. Did you find yourself when you were at Esquire kind of, was there an influence of the new journalism while you were there, or an influence say,
hey? It was way more when I was at the New York Post.
Okay.
When I was at the New York Post, Tom Wolfe was at the Herald Tribune, Jimmy Breslin was at the New York Herald Tribune, and we all had moments of letting exclamation points from Tom Wolfe creep into our pieces, or writing in a kind of Breslin-esque way. I didn't fall too much into the Breslin-esque thing, but I certainly worshipped it. I thought he was amazing, and I still do. So it was way more then, and my editor kept just striking these things out of my pieces. He was very firm about it, and I can still remember physically watching him just with his pencil as he took all my Tom Wolfe things out of my piece, because everybody caught the virus from him,
yeah.
But no one could do it but him.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed there was, I don't think I found an exclamation mark in this book anywhere.
Oh yeah, there are exclamation
there are?
Points. Oh yes, definitely.
Okay.
I'm sure in the piece about JFK, okay. I'm sure. There's. I like exclamation points. I think they're funny. So I do use them. But.
Well, there seems, I mean, I mentioned the exclamation point simply because there seems to be an interesting sort of stigma behind it, largely because, well, people think that if you use multiple exclamation points in a row, then you come across as some sort of like teenager or whatnot, but I happen to like the exclamation point.
Oh, I think it's funny, especially if it's used sort of ironically, you know.
Sure.
You can't use it too literally, but I don't see an exclamation point here. Maybe you're right. I certainly meant to use exclamation points from time to time.
If it's any consolation, I felt the spirit of an exclamation point as I was reading.
Thank you so
it. Yeah.
Much. Thank you.
Particularly during that JFK essay as well.
Yes,
yeah.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, bringing that up, you mentioned in that particular essay, I'm probably the only woman who ever worked in the Kennedy White House that the president did not make a pass at. How could you be absolutely sure of that? Maybe Kennedy was a little bit more subtle about it.
It's possible that there were a few others, but it's becoming less and less likely. Don't you think?
Well, I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah. No, no. No, I'm afraid that I was among the overlooked few. And I feel bad about that, too.
Really?
Yeah, sure. Are you kidding?
Well, it's just Kennedy. There's plenty of other men to have. I don't know.
Yeah, but you never saw Kennedy. He was something.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
I suppose even I would have probably, you know, wanted to, you know, have an affair with him, too.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, yeah, actually, I wanted to talk actually about Jonathan Yardley wrote a very nice retrospective of Crazy Salad a couple of years ago in 2004, and he noted that Hollywood's gain was journalism's loss. He noted in particular that you hooked onto your readership because you had the ability to create what, in his words, were a self-deprecating persona rooted in reality, which we were kind of talking about, which the readers can connect with. I wanted to actually sort of throw this observation into this conversation and ask how much of, you know, you as an essayist, or even maybe even you as a screenwriter, is a persona, and how much of it is truth? I mean, what is the definition here in terms of, I mean, do you consciously sort of try to sort of, you know, operate in a kind of persona? Do you tailor your voice in a way that that people, you know, might, that you can actually sort of expose universal truths that you, the real Nora, perhaps, actually, I mean, is there kind of a filtering process?
You know, I can't answer that. You'd have to ask someone like my sister or my husband that question, and I don't know what they would say. I think that there's maybe 2% that sometimes I exaggerate who I am, and sometimes I minimize who I am, but around a fairly, I think this is pretty much who I am. I think that when you find a voice, that voice is sort of you in some way, even if it's not necessarily you in the supermarket or something. It's how you look at things and how you see things. I think that I don't begin to tell the whole truth. I tell about as much of it as I'm comfortable with, and as much as I hope I can get away with. But But I think it's pretty much me. I don't think it's a performance, even though all writing is a little bit of a performance. It's a little bit of, you know, you're always standing on your head just a little teeny bit. And your energy, if you write an essay, your energy is a little bit higher than it is at all times. Because you want to get people's attention. You want people to read you. That's one reason why you use declarative senses, is you want to get, you don't want to beat around the bush. You want to say, you want to hook people. You want to say to them, it will be better for you to read this than have a cookie. And you got to be strong and have a huge amount of energy to do that. But I do have a lot of energy, even though right now I'm talking to you on the basis of so much sugar that I can't believe it. But
sugar is good.
Yeah.
Well, going back to this notion of like how much truth you can actually get away with, I mean, what do you do to sort of debate how much truth is enough to sort of convey to the readership?
Well, you don't know. And you don't know if you've told too much. You know, sometimes when I wrote that piece about breasts in 1972, I said to my editor, this is either the worst thing I've ever done or it's going to be great. I have no idea which it is. Please tell me. But I knew I was kind of going out there saying something that no one had said, you know.
So it seems very much...
And by the way, when I did When Harry Met Sally, which is in some weird way a series of essays on being single,
yeah,
that happened to come out of people's mouths as dialogue, you know, when we did that orgasm scene, I thought, well, it's a good thing this is in a movie, because if I'd written this as an essay, God knows what would have happened to me. You know, but that's the same kind of thing where you go, are people going to laugh at this, or are they going to go, oh, well, that's true for you, but not for me? Fortunately, we had done enough polling to know that it was true.
So basically, this question varies.
I no mean polling. You understand that I'm being ironic. I just asked a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the question then also is how much truth can you get away in each respective medium? Because you've written fiction, you've written essays, you've written screenplays, you've directed films and the like. Since you're working such across such a broad spectrum, you know, do you have to sort of constantly kind of calibrate?
And I blog.
I was going to mention the Huffington Post.
I blog, yes, yeah. But go on.
Do you find that you have to kind of, is this kind of a largely sort of instinctive grasp of how much truth you can actually reveal, or is there any similarities or differences?
No, it's more like figuring out something you'd like to say, and then thinking, how am I going to say this? For example, this is not interesting, but since you asked, I have been grappling for 2 or 3 years with the fact that restaurants have stopped giving you small spoons with dessert. This may not seem like anything that you would care about, but I care deeply about it because dessert gets more and more important the older you get, since you are A, in the dessert phase of your life, so you want it to last as long as possible. And when people give you a large dessert spoon to eat it with, not only does it not fit into your mouth properly, but it makes the dessert go too quickly, and then it's over, and so is the meal. And I don't like these dessert spoons. And for 2 or 3 years, it's been driving me nuts. And every time someone gives me one of these great big spoons, I say, could I have a small spoon? Some places don't even have small teaspoons anymore. They don't even stock them anymore. They have tiny little spoons for your coffee and way too big spoons for your dessert. I finally, last week, figured out a way to write this piece. Which is going to be in the New York Times tomorrow, which is probably not tomorrow on your show.
Okay.
But in any case,
it will be there.
It will have, okay. It will have been in the New York Times on the op-ed piece. But the point is, this is a very tiny thing, but it has been bugging me. Yeah. And ever since it started bugging me, I thought, I got to find a way to deal with this. Now, it's a tiny truth. Some people obviously don't agree with me, or they wouldn't be switching their restaurants over to these large dessert spoons, and I seem to be the only person objecting to them. And yet I knew at some point I was going to write something, but I just had to kind of figure out a way to do it, so then I finally did.
Well, it's also like the size of restaurant cups over the years, how if you examine, like, for example, I mean, small McDonald's cup, you know, is now totally different now than when it was like 15 years ago.
What do you mean a cup?
Like a paper cup of a small McDonald's.
Oh,
cup.
Yes.
It's like
oh, yeah.
Grown gargantuan.
I know. That's terrible, I mean, you know, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I know.
Now you're expected to sort of wolf down your food. You're expected yes. to sort of not actually sit there and enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so there, it's not just, it is a small truth, but it has sort of broad ramifications for how we enjoy desserts.
I feel metaphoric about it all, yes. Yeah.
Yeah,
but I think it's more really figuring out a thing in your head that you want to say and then realizing that, and then you kind of think, is anyone going to care if I say this? Has anyone else said it? And then if you can kind of get beyond all of those questions, how am I going to say it? So.
Certainly. Well, this is interesting because it seems to me that when you come up with a small truth or a larger truth, that there is this sort of, I guess, you have a gestation process here that kind of kicks in as to how you're going to express it, or?
Well, yeah, that's yeah. what I'm saying yeah. is that some, and sometimes, by the way, in the case of the piece about being the only woman that JFK did not sleep with, which is, it's a piece that I certainly knew I was the only person JFK had not slept with for 42 years before I wrote that piece. I wrote that piece because one morning I opened the newspaper and yet another woman turned out to have had an affair with JFK. And furthermore, she had been an intern in the Kennedy White House, and so had I. And she was so cosmically full of it. She was so self-important in her announcement, and it just made me laugh. And I sat down at the typewriter and wrote this piece in about 8 minutes, but I've been waiting 42 years to write it, you know, so.
Well, the blog format then sounds like it's an ideal format because you have to turn a lot of content really quickly.
Well, I don't turn it out so quickly because I don't blog that often. I only blog about once every week or two, but you do, I think blogs are interesting because you should write quickly on a blog. A blog should be something that feels like an exhale, like something you believe at that second, but maybe not even in several days.
I believe it was Anthony Burgess who said that he applied this to novels, that a novel should be written about urgently in one sort of great swoop, which was explains in some reason why he was so prolific.
Yeah,
but,
good luck to the rest of us.
Exactly, but do you, now for the blog entries or the blog posts, do you actually write these like an essay or outside of a blog interface and then paste them in, or do you actually write them in the interface? Or, I was wondering.
No, I just write them on my computer and then paste them in, yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if you approach these in any way differently than how you would, like, say, write, you know, this op-ed piece about spoons, you know?
Well, I tried. The blogs are a little more political, mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. In fact, they are political. I don't, you know. And I would never write. I mean, I just did a piece on Cheney's appearance on Tim Russert. I just did this little piece that was on the Huffington Post on Sunday that was basically about what Sunday morning is like when you kind of watch the talk shows and try to figure out what you're going to have for breakfast simultaneously. And that's just a little casual thing, you know. It doesn't have a whole lot of meaning, but it was just something I thought, well, this is something and I'll post it.
Actually, I wanted to kind of ask you one question about your films. And that was kind of going to this notion of pursuing truth and as well as attracting a broad audience. In your films, you often use sort of pop standards. Even in Bewitched, you had the Eagles in there. And I'm wondering where this, the impulse or the reasoning for this kind of comes from. Or is the layering of, like, you know, sort of really standard recognizable songs. Is this your way, perhaps, of, like, attracting you know, audiences into actually telling the truth, or does the truth stand alone, or maybe?
I don't know. What does the Eagles have to do with this?
Well, what I mean to say is that you're in all of your films, you're not going to find a really obscure song. You're going to find a song that almost everyone who is steeped in music is going to recognize, or even, you know, not steeped in music. And I was wondering what the motivation for this particular, you know, what drives you to put very kind of recognizable tunes in.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, because I don't know the answer. I mean, because I don't think when I'm putting the music in, oh, this is a recognizable tune. I think what song is going to make this scene work? What's the thing I can do to this scene that musically that will give it a little extra something or other without being too on the nose? So I don't think I think of it as recognizable, although some of the standards in my movies I don't think are recognizable to everyone, in that there are a lot of people who don't even know the standard vocabulary, as I'm afraid I do because I grew up with all those songs.
Well, it's sort of like Kubrick lying in the Strauss march is the waltz is the temp track, and then it becomes the actual sort of thing. So
yes,
sometimes the obvious kind of, you know, selection might actually
yes,
be the right one.
Yes, well, that's true. That's true, yeah.
Well, I know you have to go, and I have a zillion questions, but it was
a
pleasure.
Oh, well, this is really fun.
It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. God, I'm shocked.